With the Feast of Trumpets coming along, I thought it, my mind went to various prophetic themes. One of the ideas I was going to develop was what it's like to go through the Great Tribulation, which of course will be prior to Christ's return. And no, it's not listening to one of my sermons. That's not what it's like to go through the Great Tribulation. Maybe close, but not exactly there yet. But there seemed to be, I spoke on prophecy and I gave my sermon or my PowerPoint presentation last week to the San Diego church, Arabia in Prophecy. And then all of a sudden, all of these events happen in Syria. And I know that people get prompted to think about Bible prophecy in a time like this, and really a very, very strange and serious set of situations that have just come about recently this week. And though you may have heard these 5 points before, if you keep them in mind and you can orient them in your mind, I really believe they're very valuable to us and helpful to us, and I kind of weaved it into my sermon last week, but if you can remember that there are 5 basic areas of prophecy in the Bible, and everything that has to do with the end time centers around these 5 basic themes. Now, if you know of other themes, then, man, bring me into the discussion on that because I'd like to know. But I think I memorized them. I tried to. I won't look at my notes, but in no particular order, we know what those 5 areas of prophecy that are defined in the Bible are. And they are the rise of a superpower in Europe, the rise of a powerful church in Europe, still not looking, Middle East in crisis, the work of God, and the decline in power and prestige of the United States and British Commonwealth peoples. Maybe you thought I wouldn't get them, but I did. So I really worked hard on that this week to make sure I got those down. They are on my notes, but I do know them. But if you think about these 5 areas and what is going on in the world, you can basically come to an agreement and figure out what really is happening in the world. And I hope that that is really clear as we go through this message today. So where are we now in the scheme of prophetic events? Let's take these one by one, go through a few scriptures, and take a look at the first one, which, again, in no particular order, we have always thought that there will be a rising superpower in Europe. Why do we think that? Well, for a variety of reasons and scriptures and evidences in the Bible, in Bible prophecy, it points to that. Let's turn to, and it's complete in the book of Daniel. If you only had the book of Daniel, you'd be able to figure this out. So in Daniel chapter 2, we're exposed to this dream of Nebuchadnezzar, as you'll remember. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream that he couldn't figure out what it was. He called his wise men. He asked them what the dream was, and they couldn't tell him. They couldn't tell him what the dream was. They couldn't even begin to tell him what the dream was, much less the interpretation of that dream. And so Daniel came to the rescue, and he helped him to understand what this dream was, and that even Nebuchadnezzar's part in the whole purpose of this particular prophecy. In verse 31, we read, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image." This is a marvelous thing to be able to tell somebody what they had actually dreamed without having that information revealed to him. "This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, and its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And you watched while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on its feet in clay and broke them in pieces." So at the bottom of the image, this stone, not cut with hands, pounces on it. And, you know, we're taken through history, through over 3,500 years of prophecy in this one or these 2 verses. And it shows the obliteration of this image, which is defined elsewhere in the book of Daniel as a king or a kingdom. And in fact, it's even a representation of Nebuchadnezzar, as we find out. In verse 35, the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. It'd make a beautiful movie image, wouldn't it, to see this just all crumble to pieces and the wind blow it away. And in its place is the kingdom of God. So it takes us through that much history. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Obviously, understanding Bible prophecy demands that you understand the symbols that the Bible uses. The stone, Jesus Christ, you know, the one that the builders refused. The mountain is a government. And there are other symbols of government that are brought out, as we know that the Bible basically interprets itself. And so he goes on to describe the rest of this dream, and he describes to him basically that this dream and this image that is represented in this dream represents world-ruling kingdoms that would exist through history. The immediate history would be the ancient world of which Daniel was a part of, being a captive from Judah and being in Babylon through these years of 603 to 539 B.C., etc. And when they were carried away captive, you know, they realized that they had been punished for their neglect of God. And so it shows the rise of kingdoms. As we know that in the next few verses, you've read it many times before, the Babylonian kingdom would be followed by the Persian kingdom, followed by the Grecian kingdom, and then the largest of all would be the Roman kingdom that would follow after that. So in verse 44, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. This is a really great common theme to remember, that at the end of all of these prophetic utterances is the kingdom of God. That is encouraging. At the end of all of this is the kingdom of God. Studied a little bit about the Great Tribulation, studied about some of the things that are prophesied to happen during the last 3.5 years prior to Christ's return. Thought that might be a fitting kind of introduction into the Feast of Trumpets, and kind of backed away from it. It's, you know, not that it's discouraging for God's people, but it's very discouraging in its scope, its epic scope as to what is going to happen to this world. And, you know, then the question obviously is, you know, how many of us will remain alive until that time? And do you want to go through that time, the Great Tribulation? So it was a little bit of a downer. So I decided to go in a different direction. Maybe I'll have the courage to talk about this some other time. Very interesting concept, though, really is. So stay tuned, maybe someday. Verse 45, inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and it had broken pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. And throughout the book, that is a recurring theme, and a little bit more detail is added on, such as in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7, beginning in verse 2. Daniel, this is further along in the history of Babylon, to where the grandson, I believe, of Nebuchadnezzar is now in charge of Babylon. And Daniel is interpreting his dream because he's known to be able to understand and interpret dreams. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the great winds of heaven were stirring up the great... Well, pardon me, this is Daniel's vision, sorry, his dream. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. The great sea is the Mediterranean Sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. And after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird, and the beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this I saw in the night visions, behold, a great beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. And it had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it. and it had 10 horns. So Daniel sees, you know, a little bit more information about these world-ruling kingdoms, beasts or kingdoms or kings. Even Nebuchadnezzar, as we know, was changed. His heart was changed to the heart of a beast. And he became like that for 7 years. And then finally, God brought him out of that stupor, and he regained his senses. And he, you know, in his own pagan way, I suppose, he thanked God that he had been restored and that his sanity had been restored. But the Bible calls these nations beasts. And if you are watching what happens in the world today, you see such beastly behavior and attitudes, which maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but according to the conventions of war that all civilized people have agreed to, it's wrong to use chemical weapons. I mean, imagine, I'm not making fun or, you know, creating a parody here of the whole thing, but death is death, right? If people are killed, they don't know it. I mean, once they're dead, you're dead. You don't really know it. And is there any humane way to annihilate your opponents? You know, maybe it's not okay to vaporize them in a nuclear holocaust, but it's okay to kill them with traditional weapons like a knife or a bullet. I mean, imagine how crazy that is, and contrast it with what's going to be happening in the world tomorrow, where there's none of that nonsense. And the world decided, I guess, after World War I, that the use of chemical warfare was inhumane. You know, think about it. An inhumane way of killing somebody, which by definition, I kind of think that's kind of inhumane, isn't it? So we settle on these norms as to what is humane and what isn't. And it's like, why didn't they just go ahead in the Geneva Convention and outlaw bullets and tanks and guns? If you know, because none of it is really a good way to die. When you know, if you're on the other side of the trench, it's okay. Hand grenades are okay, but tanks are verboten. Yeah, we don't want any of those tanks. But gas, you know, chemical warfare is, you know, another one of these heinous ways. We'll cover that a little bit. You know, I mean, this is in the news here recently. You just can't ignore it. I mean, I know that none of you are ignoring it. You can't ignore what is going on, and even the recent developments that have happened today. Again, all of this ends with the return of Christ. Verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. And then the rest of the explanation of the vision is covered throughout the rest of the chapter, specifically in verse 23. The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth. So we know that that's the Roman Empire, known in history as the Holy Roman Empire, described throughout the Bible. Daniel chapter 8, just incredible prophecies. All of these are Daniel 8, verse 9. And out of one of them, that is one of these horns, out of one of them came a little goat which grew exceedingly great towards the south and towards the east and towards the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away. Does appear that at some time in the future there will be a point at which there are daily sacrifices, like there used to be anciently, set up in Jerusalem. Maybe at the site of the temple. Maybe at a temple to be built. Those are things that we don't see on the horizon. We don't see them now, but could they come about? Sure, they could. We don't know exactly how it will be, and it would just be speculation to go outside the lines on this one. But it appears as though that observance of these sacrifices is going to be taken away for 1,150 days, 2,300 mornings and evenings, 2,300 times, you know, divided by two, morning and evening. Some of your Bibles even have this, verse 14, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. And it appears as though it will be cleansed, because what happened in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes with the statue of Jupiter being placed in, and some believe that that statue still exists and is elsewhere in the world. And it's a huge marble edifice, much larger than life, that was placed apparently in the temple, and, you know, swine were sacrificed instead of the sacrificial animals of God. And that temple was desecrated. This would be the second temple, not Solomon's temple, but the second temple that was rebuilt, beginning and finished in about 515 BC. So there will be another temple, a third temple, perhaps. That is the implication by Bible prophecy. And sacrifice is offered. Why would they do that? Why would they do that that they're not doing now? It would have to be because they're impelled of some crisis to want to, in their own way, seek God. That is my reasoning to do that. And because it's not happening now, could there be some kind of spiritual application of this and something that, you know, I'm just not getting right now? I suppose there could be, but I would guess that, you know, what we have thought all along is probably correct, that there will be a time of sacrifices, morning and the evening, that will take place, and then that eventually the temple will be cleansed after that is stopped. And so all of that is described in these verses as well. In verse 15, then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, an angel, an angelic being. These angels have brought information to God's people, well, from the time that man has existed on the earth at various times. That kingdom, that last kingdom, is described beginning in verse 23. Now, these kingdoms are also described in the book of Revelation in chapter 13. We all know about that. Revelation 13 begins to describe the same kind of beasts, the same coming out of the Mediterranean Sea, the same information is presented here. It's consistent with the book of Daniel, as we know. John now is transported to the Mediterranean Sea, and he stood on the sand of the sea, verse 1. And I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. Forgot to mention that back in Daniel, all of those beasts are described as kingdoms. That's what the Bible symbols mean. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns. And on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. This last beast has all of the attributes of the previous ones, and this is in the time of the end. This one takes place not just historically, but from a prophetic standpoint, in that time of the end. And so this dragon, we look to, you know, for this reason, for a number of other reasons, and other scriptures, we look for a rising superpower in Europe. Now, can you honestly say, I mean, yeah, there is nothing going on in Europe right now. Now, could that change at the drop of a hat? Yes, it could. Europe is weak. Europe is not together. Europe is not together politically, economically, or in virtually any other way. So right now, a powerful European superpower is just a prophetic utterance. It is not there. That's as sure as anything. That's as sure as it's being there, as we know. But it's not there yet, and it hasn't arisen yet. They have framework. They have constitutions. They've got lofty language. They had a currency, which basically sucks right now. We thought that was going to be the euro. We thought it was going to replace the dollar. It hasn't. God has allowed this nation to stay powerful, in a sense, until it's his time, not ours. So there is a Europe to rise, but it's not here yet. No one can say that. You can't point to any evidence that shows a powerful Europe. France is the only nation that decided that they would go along with us in this foray into Syria, which ought to cause anybody pause to think. Well, wait a minute. If that's the only ones that you've got, I don't care if they've been called our oldest ally, not to make, are any of you French? Boy, I should have said something about that. You're not French. Are you? Maybe that explains something. I don't know, but just kidding. But unstable is water. I mean, why would you say, okay, that's the French have given their approval, then that's all we need. Nobody says that in the world today. I'm making fun of kind of a very serious situation, but you get the point. I mean, it's not like they've really been warriors, if you get my drift, throughout the 20th century. It's, you know, they're most famous for their main product, which is the production of, not wine, but white flags. That's been best for it. Anyway, just kidding. So Revelation chapter 13 talks about how these groups, how this beast, how this nation, how these groups of nation actually worshiped the dragon in verse 4, who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months, 3.5 years. Great tribulation. The great tribulation will coincide with the rising up of this superpower. And then, well, I think that in type we can see how deception can begin, because why there is not a moral outrage and white hot anger among the American public over, I think, something most of you can see as to what is so drastically wrong with our nation shows the level of deception, I think, in our own nation as to what is actually going on. Why there's not an outcry from, you know, the religious right over some of the horrid, perverted ways of our being as a nation. It's just incredible. Maybe there are in some quarters. I think there are, but it's incredible. More on that later. But anyway, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and overcome them. And authority was given over every tribe, tongue, and nation. It will rule the earth. There is no conglomeration of nations in Europe that is ready to assume the mantle of that role. Verse 11, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. Now, make no mistake, when the pontiff speaks today, people listen. When they issue an utterance from the Vatican, it gains attention. It gains world news. Nothing like the scope that it will be in the future, where it will absolutely convict and command and convey a message of strong authority and point to the government, which is saying, you know, this is to whom you should pledge your allegiance to, all people on earth. That power is not there. And several months ago in a sermon on the beast and the false prophet, I think there are two different sermons, I stated my opinion, and believe me, it's only an opinion, it's just a best guess, that last pope will be of Italian descent, and the leader of this beast power will be of German descent. And I say that not because I have courage, because there are some people of German descent that are not here today. I'm not saying that boldly now. It's only because of history, that every resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire has had someone of German descent over it. Even Napoleon, his descent can be traced. Justinian the Great, the Frankish kingdom, they have all been centered. They have all come from people that come from Central Europe, the German people. So every one of them. So it's just a guess, and it's just a theory, but just keep it at that. Turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 12. Now this, maybe some of that great tribulation stuff did creep in here, because this certainly does point to that time in which there will be this particular individual. He's mentioned in Revelation 13, the little horn, he's mentioned here. Now, brethren, concerning 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 1, Concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. You know, so it indicates a falling away of faithful individuals from the faith. That's entirely possible. And then the man of sin revealed. And as an opinion, only an opinion, that revelation could take place quite innocently when a new pope is chosen. A few puffs of smoke and then there is a new one, and maybe not everyone really recognizes what has actually happened. I don't think these things, whether we're talking about the rise of the United States of Europe, this particular pontiff which is mentioned here, it's not going to happen in good times, stable times, in my view. Just an opinion. Happens at times of crisis. Why do I say that? Because historically, desperate despots come to power under desperate times and difficult times. That's what happened with Mussolini, Adolf Hitler. They didn't come to power through stable times. They had other world leaders that would stand up to them and did, thankfully, at that particular time, Churchill being the most prominent, obviously. Incredible will and valor, and, you know, his 1940 speech to the House of Commons is one of the most famous speeches in the history of mankind, and nothing vacillating about it. You know, we will fight them in the fields. We will never, never, ever give up. I'm not even going to try to remember all of it, but it was thrilling. It was inspiring, and it was the kind of speech-making that we haven't seen in a long time, the incredible leadership that came to the forefront at that particular time. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come. Okay, sorry for that. Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. You know, actually worshipped. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things, and now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time? You know, they thought the end of time was there in their lifetime. In a sense, it was. I mean, they lived, they died, and they'll wake up at the resurrection. So it doesn't really matter what time you live, what time you die, as long as, you know, you have the information you have now, that you respond accordingly. You respond as God wants you to respond, to his commandments. I preface my sermon this morning by saying that I've known people who've just got all bug-eyed about prophecy, and then, you know, then the race is on to try to figure out, okay, when's this going to happen? Okay, what about all of these open spaces to where we don't have the detail to fit in? I'll just go find the detail. Well, you know, go have at it if you want to, but I give broad outlines and try to give opinion where I think maybe I have an opinion that's worth stating, and maybe it's not really, but nothing concrete, nothing ironclad in terms of all these white spaces in prophecy. There just are. There's these, what I mean by that? I mean, there are areas to which the Bible hasn't addressed the detail, the level of detail that, you know, it must be a part of human nature to innately want to, you know, have Roman numeral 1 and then A, large A, capital, and then 1, 2, 3, and then under that, small A, B, C, and fine, you know, all the fine lines. There's a lot of open space there, a lot of white space in terms of, but there's enough to know that this person is not on the scene right now. He's not in power. This religious leader is not there, because the deception is going to be so vast that Christ told the disciples, and it's recorded in several of the gospel accounts, that even the elect could be deceived. Such would be the cunning. Such would be the power of this individual and this lawlessness that will pervade the rest of the world. You could probably come up with a lot of good ideas as to how that lawlessness will take place. Well, obviously, it will be in contradiction to God's commands, God's laws, the Sabbath day will be out the window in terms, and Sabbath observance is going to be condemned and outlawed. That would be a certain possibility. God's people will begin to stand out when they are known for their observance. Even in, you know, as a forerunner to these things, I think that we are given kind of clues even in the present day, where in Egypt you've had a persecution of Christians in their recent problems. In Syria, you've had a persecution of people who call themselves Christians. You know, so what is so hard to believe that in the future there will be a martyrdom of saints? It's God's people stand out by definition because of the things that they believe and that they hold dear. Verse 8, then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this reason God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. We don't know how close we are to that time, but the identification of this individual has not been made. I've given you my theories and opinions. For more information, I'm going to cite for you Daniel 8, verses 9 through 19. You can just go there. I don't want to go to that, because right along with this, we talk about the work of God, and I really appreciate the emails, the comments that some of you gave very, very recently to a sermon, and I asked you to come up with your conclusion as to the matter of church growth. And I was really amazed at some of the good replies that I got. So thank you. I won't single them out or mention them individually or anything like that, but it really showed me that God's people have it together, to be honest with you. Just some good information. The work of God is something that Mr. Armstrong stressed, because he always would go back to Matthew 24, verse 14. And this gospel shall be preached in all the world for a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. Which makes a lot of sense, that there will be a lot of work that is done, whether by us, other groups, or by the two witnesses in Revelation 11, because it seems to me that there is a parallelism with this man of sin being revealed, and it seems to me that prophecy indicates that these two witnesses will be there thwarting the information that is false and that is antagonistic to God, and these two individuals, who again have not yet been identified, although I had a friend that I went to college with that thinks he and his wife are the two witnesses, and that he's God's apostle and his wife's a prophet. So not sure how that's working out. But anyway, I'm just going to state that I don't think they are. Just an opinion. But other people have claimed they're the two witnesses. There are people that came in groups of three to Pasadena campus 30, 40 years ago claiming to be the two witnesses. But the work of God, we know what those individuals will do, and I think that they'll be very effective, and I think that there will be a lot of, if you want to call it church growth at that time, through their ministry, through the Great Tribulation. Revelation 6 indicates that as much, that there will be a lot of individuals who are called and converted, and by circumstances, God uses what happens around us to convict individuals. Well, that's the third area of prophecy in this sermon. Next, let's turn to Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. It really appears as though the transition from a historical relevance to a modern day or prophetic application in this chapter begins at verse 40. Now, previously, it talks about some of those things that we had talked about before, the daily sacrifices being taken away anciently, 168 B.C. or thereabouts, with one of the descendants, or not the descendants, but one of the inheritors of the kingdom of Greece, which in this case was the Seleucid dynasty, which came into Israel, and Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the representative of that, one of those four divisions who inherited the power of Alexander after his sudden and abrupt death. And this individual, or a descendant of that particular dynasty, came into Israel, and you know, they slaughtered a bunch of Jews. And all of this seems to be somewhat prophetic and also historic. Certainly was prophetic when Daniel uttered it in the 5th century B.C. But at verse 40, it really seems to change to a modern context, a prophetic context for us in the future. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. When this happens, you'll know that we're really in the midst of the time of the end, but we're nowhere near close to that now. In terms of events, I say we're nowhere near close to that. Now, can war change things, alter the scope of things very quickly? You bet. But right now, there is no king of the north. There is nothing that we have seen in Revelation 13 that shows any inkling or desire or ability or need for a king of the south to come to power. It's not there. We have 5 battleships in the Mediterranean Sea ready to lob cruise missiles and Tomahawk missiles at targets undetermined, and for a short period of time, whatever good that would ever do, I don't know. No goal in mind, no targets, all of them moved critically. Interesting. Oh, well, it's just, man, don't get me started. Don't get myself started on this whole thing. But this is going to happen. This is going to be a prelude to the return of Christ, as we know, where this European kingdom may be on a great crusade to save Jerusalem, which will sound noble, I'm sure, at the time, to save Jerusalem, just like we did in the Middle Ages. But yet, it's going to end, of course, with the return of Jesus Christ. But in the meantime, in verse 45, he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. This is definitely the time of the end, and this is the conclusion of events in the Middle East. Now, we still have a lot of white space, shall we say. We don't know who is the king of the south. There is no king of the south. The first time I began to hear some of these sermons live and about prophecy, I remember writing in my first Bible, my first wide margin Bible, there was only one king of all of the Confederation of Arab States at the time in 1973, and that was King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, and he's long since deceased. We didn't know then where the king of the south would come from, and we don't know now. Egypt is the most populous nation, but if you remember the PowerPoint, there's 500 million or more Muslims living right around the area of the Middle East and surrounding Israel, population 7.7 million. That's a lot of folks. It's very possible that person is alive today, but we don't know who it is. It could be a caliphate. It could be a religious leader that will spring forward and unite the various sects of the Islamic faith, the Sunnis, the Shiites, the two predominant ones, and then all the rest. It's very possible that they will suspect a common foe and they will unite. And right now, they're fighting a war against one another. And the strange thing is, you remember about a year ago, we had this thing, an attack on one of our consulates in Libya. Well, there's a lot of suspicion, and this really gets into the realm of case. Since it's not widely reported and it's not reported by a reputable news source, then all we can do is wonder. whether or not arms were being gathered up, that we had armed the Libyan rebels to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi, and those arms were being gathered together to be shipped off to Turkey to divert to Syrian rebels who were opposing Assad, which is now controlled by Al-Qaeda. And so, you know, it's a no-win situation that we're in. Al-Qaeda is trying to depose a horrid dictator, and they tried to – wait a minute, let's figure this out. They tried to – and they did exact a great amount of damage to our nation 11 years ago, 12 years ago, and now we are trying to arm them. And I think that part is true, actually, the munitions and arms feeding to Al-Qaeda rebels who are trying to overthrow another heinous dictator. There's no good person in the fight here. There's no good guy. There's no warrior who's great. They're all bad. They're all horrible. They're all jackals. They're all evil beasts. It's just amazing. So the Middle East is always going to be something that we'll want to look to. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if something drastically horrid, wrong happened to Israel, happened to us, surprise attacks on 9/11. That is, you know, it's what happened in Libya, although, you know, the smartest people in the world can't really figure out that that was an attack by terrorism on our consulate. It's mind-boggling. Isaiah 3 shows, I'm not going to turn there, Isaiah 3 shows children shall be their leaders. The naivete that is present in the world leadership today is astonishing, in our leadership in this nation. So there's no king of the South. There's no king of the North. But we know, as we know, that the descendants of these people that are mentioned in the Bible, have basically stayed in that area. There's various tribes. There are various groups of them. We isolated their historical antecedents in the sermon several months ago and show where they possibly are today. And you can go to Genesis 25 and verse 13. It gives you some information as to the sons of Ishmael. And many of the descendants of the Middle East are from these groups, these tribes, these 12 princes, et cetera, et cetera. Now let's go to Genesis chapter 49. Genesis 49. A pivotal chapter of Bible prophecy, because really the most important key to understanding Bible prophecy, and this is where people come right up to the edge, really seem to have some understanding, and yet without this pivotal key in understanding Bible prophecy, you are shut out. Who is Israel in Bible prophecy? Who is Jacob in Bible prophecy? Who are the sons of Jacob in Bible prophecy? Who is Joseph in Bible prophecy? They're all the same people. They're all the same people, as you know. Genesis 49, verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough. That is, his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph didn't have the sons of Issachar and others, Benjamin, Levi. They weren't his sons. They're Jacob's sons, but Joseph had two sons, and his two sons inherited the promises of Abraham, the bulk of the national promises, and they were withheld for 2,520 years after they went into captivity for their disobedience, which we are going into again because of our disobedience to God. You see the evidence all around us, ever so slightly every day. It's getting worse and worse. But Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well, well-watered. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. You know, God has been behind the expansion of power of the United States and British Commonwealth peoples. No doubt. It's just unbelievable. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Separate. They had some distinct national characteristics that are mentioned in Genesis 49. And have they been blessed? Yeah. Not like this. Not anywhere near like this. But has the blessing been shared around the world of what has been done, what God has done in this nation? Absolutely. I mentioned this several weeks ago. It's kind of hard to believe for a lot of us that, you know, the 70s were a significant time of diminishing resources, diminishing hopes and expectations in many ways, quite honestly, until Ronald Reagan came along. We were taught in the 70s, basically, that we were running out of oil and that our days as a nation and our dependence on oil and our dependence on other nations was going to be short-lived because we had all these enemies overseas. The United States is now on track to become the world's largest oil producer by 2017. And that's not fiction. That's just the steady progression of growth of the energy industry in this nation. And we could be, as I said before, the Shell Oil president, I heard him say it several times, he's retired now, we could be self-sufficient totally in 5 years. And that's kind of the caveat. If we were to get beyond all the mess that we have now, would God grant this nation another period of time of prosperity? It's possible, but looming on the horizon are so many factors that, you know, we have brought on ourselves this incredible debt, $17 trillion right now in national debt. And as that moves forward, the servicing, that is the interest on that debt, grows ever more burdensome. And in 10 more years, it becomes far greater, just the consequences of that debt and the payments that have to be extracted. And just to make payments on that debt are far more than the gross national product of the country. So it's bankruptcy city. And if you do not have the power of your currency and if you do not have the power of your economy, you cease to be a world power. Now, that could be the consequence. But isn't it incredible? Russia is the largest producer of oil in the world now. They have been. They outstripped Saudi Arabia some time ago. Saudi Arabia is next. We're next and catching up with both of them. Through everything that we have available in this country, the blessings beneath, as Abraham said, you know, we had so many false assumptions in the 60s and the 70s that were never really valid, and they were based on people who were, I'm not saying the church, but we had a lot of doomsdayers that had no biblical backing at all. They were kind of secular prophets that actually, when you look back on them, they were wrong. They were totally wrong. You know, the population curve by Paul Ehrlich, he wasn't right. You know, our population is two or three times what he said it had to be in order for there to be mass starvation on the planet. So he's wrong. Running out of energy in this country, there are some theories. Now, this would be theoretical. There are some theories that say this idea that there's only a set amount of fossil fuels in the world and that once we're exhausted, that's just a theory now because there's some people that think that that gas and oil is a constant flux continually going and continually being made throughout the year. So Joseph has been a fruitful bough. The events of the Middle East will not happen prophetically in a vacuum. You're not going to have all of these things happen at separate times. In other words, the decline in power of the prestige U.S., the rise of the power of Europe, a powerful European church, the work of God, they're all going to come together at a conclusion, in my opinion. This is called editing. Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 20. We've gotten to the end. If you need more scriptures to study, I'll send you the notes. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 20. And this is a blessings and cursings chapter. I think all we have to do is go here. to explain the situation of today. Again, in my view, the Lord will send on you cursing, confusion, and rebuke in all that you set your hand to do until you are destroyed and until you perish quickly because of the wickedness of your doings in which you have forsaken me. And we forsook God, our ancestors did. 700 years before Christ, they went into captivity. We are forsaking God as a nation now. We export some of the most heinous filth in terms of our culture. There should be more outrage against that. But, you know, we're not here. I'm not saying these things from a political standpoint at all. I'm just saying it from an observational standpoint. You know, sometimes we get so politically correct in our society, we just feel like, oh, well, we can't say anybody is wrong. And there's a lot wrong. It's going on. So today, as we're going down to services in Sierra Vista, we're listening to Fox News and radio, and very fearful that we are going to do something as a nation really incredibly dumb by sending cruise missiles into Syria. And for what reason? Because an utterance was made that you go this far, you better not do this, and then they did. Or maybe they didn't. Maybe it was all a setup. There's some people that think it was all a setup to goad the United States into action, you know, to attack Assad. And but last night, apparently, there were second thoughts. And now, after the declaration of our Secretary of State, which was incredibly powerful for somebody like that, yesterday you may have heard, if you don't Google it or YouTube it or something, find it, because it was a very powerful statement. We are going to act, and we're going to act very quickly. It's going to happen now within, you know, we've already telegraphed to the world, hey, be ready, here it comes, 2 or 3 days at the outset, you know, not any later than that. Here's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to strike, limited strike. We're not out to win any wars nowadays. We're limited strike. And I was thinking to myself, please do not do this. And so now Congress is going to be brought in, and that'll be the way out. That'll be the loophole. Congress is not going to stand for it. And then, oh, well, you know, we wanted to do it. We were outraged. But the separation of powers doesn't allow me. Now, it didn't stop from a lot of other executive orders in the past 6 years, but now it will. So, but it's confusing, and it's incredibly strange, the times that we are living in, and all that it will continue to do is to foment more anti-American sentiment. So we got to the point to where if we make a proclamation, the only thing that is respected is power in some parts of the world, and not that we should have done what we said we were going to do or that the president said he was going to do. But, wow, what a strange turn of events. Incredible. I call it confusion. And you have to give President Bush 41 some credit for on the eve of the attack on Iraq in Gulf War I, he and his Secretary of State got down on their knees in the Oval Office and prayed about the matter. They did. Look it up. And we know that certainly his son was a very devout Christian person and, you know, maybe did a lot of wrong things too. I'm not here to judge or give accolades, but at least believed in God. Our nation is forgetting God. Not everyone, but a lot. The decline of power in modern-day Israel is what is at the focal point of prophecy today. And we have forgotten God, and I believe that that is what is going to lead to these other four areas of prophecy coming to pass in the time of the end.